Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
Our guest today on The Enemies List is Jeffrey Toobin. Jeffrey Toobin, you have seen him on CNN and everywhere else, breaking down some of the most complex and difficult and baroque legal issues in the country for a while now. But lately, you've also seen him breaking down the many, 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 many cases that Donald Trump is facing in many, many courts and venues in a very clear and dispassionate way. And I want to welcome Jeffrey to the program today because we've talked a good bit on the show about Trump's cases, and a lot of my listeners have been sort of, I won't say unhappy, but dismayed that I'm kind of skeptical about the power of any of these cases to put Trump in jail or change the election. So, Jeffrey, I wanted to start with you and break down a couple of these things, and maybe we're just going to be too skeptics today about the power of the courts anymore to handle the Donald Trump enterprise. So let's start out. I want to talk about a case that's very fresh in everybody's mind. The Fannie Willis situation in Georgia, I think that although the judge sort of made the right call, it really has compromised the case, her judgment in that. Where do you stand on that case, both on the merits of the case itself and on sort of the shenanigans and the outside influences that have sort of shaken it up a bit?
Well, Rick, I don't want to get too technical here and speak in legalese, but the Fannie Willis case is a mess. It is a total mess. And that case is never, ever getting to trial before the November election. I mean, I think that's the most important message. Let me give you one fact about a racketeering case in Fulton County, Georgia, Atlanta. There is pending currently a big racketeering case. It's, you know, very different. And jury selection, not the trial, jury selection in that racketeering case took 1 year. Now, that's an obscenity. A legal system shouldn't function that way. But that gives you some idea of how the legal system moves in Fulton County. So this case at the moment has nothing scheduled in terms of a trial. But even if it's somehow staggered to a beginning of a trial in August, September, there would never be a trial before November. So we can talk about, you know, the Lifetime movie that that trial has become, you know, with the prosecutor and her one-time deputy involved in this romantic relationship. That's sort of an interesting novelty. But in terms of the political significance of the case, that case is over in terms of the November election. Just to answer your question directly, briefly, I think actually if you had a trial about whether Donald Trump interfered in the counting of the votes in Georgia in 2020, I think the prosecution has a decent case. You know, everybody, I think, probably remembers the infamous phone call to the Secretary of State, find me those votes. But that's not the only evidence in the case. I mean, it is a good case in the abstract. But in the real world, I think we can just cross that case off as having any political impact at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get in the way of a lot of people who try to sort of fanboy and fangirl Fannie Willis, but they had to know this was coming. They had to know they were facing up against the biggest opposition research machine in the world and that any demerits or flaws in the prosecution team were going to get put under a spotlight.
They did. They should have known. It was incredibly unwise for the two of them to get involved in this relationship at that time. Frankly, I don't think Donald Trump or any of the other defendants were prejudiced by that relationship. I don't think the fact that they were involved in a relationship helped the case against him. If anything, it hurt the case. So the idea that there was some sort of conspiracy to hurt Donald Trump is really ridiculous. But and I don't begrudge the defense lawyers doing their job. There was an opening here. They took advantage of it. Similar thing is happening in the Manhattan case and in the two federal cases. I mean, look, defense lawyers have a job to do, and I don't begrudge them doing it. You know, my thought as a former prosecutor and as an observer of this system is you have to be ready, and you have to, you know, bring your A game if you're going to try a case against a prominent defendant with good defense lawyers. And so far in Georgia, they haven't done it, and they have, you know, they have suffered the consequences.
It interests me in some ways that the cases that were initially thought to be sort of the slam dunks, the documents case in South Florida, the classified documents case, and the Georgia case, have both sort of gotten pretty badly derailed in the procedural moves that have been made in the courts themselves.
Well, they're very different problems in both cases. I certainly never referred to either of them or the other two as slam dunks. I never thought they were. The real problem in Florida is the judge. The Judge Cannon, who is a very inexperienced Trump appointee to the federal bench in South Florida, has been conducting this trial in such a way that it makes it almost impossible for this case to get to trial before November. She is slow walking everything. She has made rulings that favor Trump in ways that I don't think other judges would. And I can't really blame Jack Smith and his team for that. That was simply a matter of bad luck in terms of which judge they drew in South Florida. But it's a very troubled prosecution. There, I don't think you can blame the prosecutors, but the net result appears to be similar in that it doesn't look like that case is going to trial in 2024 either.
So I guess the other big fish case, and the one I think is the most consequential for the sort of American democracy, for the Republic, is the January 6th case in D.C., which is sort of wrapped up in immunity questions and a bunch of other stuff. What do you think the state of play is on that case at the moment?
Well, I agree with you in the sense that that's the most important case. It's the most important case legally. It has the most severe penalties associated with it if there's a conviction. And just in terms of the magnitude of what is charged in terms of American history, it's enormous because it is about overthrowing the most important election we have in this country. That case is on hold. There is no litigation proceeding pending the Supreme Court's decision in the claim by former President Trump that he is immune from prosecution for all acts that took place during his presidency. It's a really broad and expansive claim. I think most people suspect that even this conservative Supreme Court will not rule in his favor, at least to the degree he wants. But again, the schedule and the delay has worked very much to his advantage. That case is going to be argued in the Supreme Court on April 25th. It's unlikely that we will see a decision in that case until sometime in June. Assuming that the Supreme Court allows the case to proceed, and there are ways that the Supreme Court could slow things down, but assuming they don't slow things down, Judge Chutkan in Washington has said that there will be at least 2 months of pretrial proceedings there, leading to the possibility that a trial would begin sometime around Labor Day. That does seem possible, although the idea that a major presidential candidate will spend September and October, and it certainly will be at least a 2 month trial, on trial in Washington at the peak of the campaign sort of makes your head explode. And I don't know if that will actually happen. And Judge Chutkan is going to have a very tough decision in deciding whether to schedule it that way. But that certainly is at least a possibility that case will go to trial before the election. Unlike Judge Cannon, the other federal judge in this, Chutkan does appear anxious to get this case on the road, but she's been stymied here by the Supreme Court, at least so far.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, folks, there are always things people need to get off their chests. We carry around a lot of stress in this world. Some of it's big, some of it's small, but all of it, if we keep it bottled up, can affect our health in a negative way. Therapy is a safe place to get things off your chest, to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down, to learn how to deal with those stresses. I know so many people who've benefited so much from therapy. They find a safe place where they can talk about the challenges in their life, where they can learn positive coping skills, they can learn how to set boundaries, and they can learn how to assess what's happening in their world in a way that makes them that better version of themselves. Therapy isn't just for people who've been through trauma or suffered a loss. It's for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Wilson today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Wilson. There was a lot of skepticism, including some from me, on the Supreme Court's delay here. But you mentioned that you felt like the court would not hold Trump immune to any liability for acts he committed as president. Well, what's your thinking on that? Because I sort of wake up in the morning and I wonder if John Roberts, thinking about the court as an institution, what kind of wedge he feels himself in. On the one side, the legal precedent that would be setting in terms of redefining executive power, and on the other side, the blowback they will receive, because they are, I think, increasingly conscious of the political climate in the country. Support for Rick Wilson's The Enemies List comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Wilson. That's odoo.com/Wilson. Odoo, modern management made simple.
It's a very tough situation for Roberts, especially now that he is really not in control of the court in the way that chief justices usually are. There are five justices to his right. And as we saw in the Dobbs abortion case, the five can outvote Roberts. So he is not in a position to lead the court in a way that he once was, and the chief justices often are. You know, as I see it in the Supreme Court, there are two likely possibilities. And one of which is simply affirming the D.C. Circuit and saying there is no immunity here, and the case can proceed. That, I think, is the correct result. I think there will be at least three votes on the court for that. That's the famous question that Judge Pan asked in the D.C. Circuit of Trump's lawyer, is that, you know, if Trump used SEAL Team 6, Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate an opponent, would that be immune under your view? And the lawyer said essentially yes. That's, you know, an absurd position in American law. My cynical view of what the Supreme Court might do is that they would say, no, there is no such thing as absolute immunity. However, some acts may be immune, and we have to send this case back to Washington, back to the DC Circuit, back to the district court for hearings on whether the activity charged here is within the ambit of what we define as immune conduct. That would have the sort of political advantage for the Supreme Court of ruling against Trump, but it would be the gift to Trump because it would create a whole new round of hearings and delays, which would make a trial in 2024 impossible. So that's something to keep an eye on, whether they rule against Trump, but in a way that makes a trial impossible.
You know, I think about the worst case scenario in my head is they just say, yep, he's immune. And somehow it just like, let's just, you know, as a counterfactual or as a hypothetical, if they do that, I don't think Americans yet understand how fundamentally that reorganizes American political life, how much power will be reposed in the executive branch if that happens.
It's not just American political life. It's American law. I mean, if there is a bedrock principle of American law, it's that no one is above the law. And the idea that we have one person in American life, the president of the United States, who can do literally anything he wants, no matter how corrupt, no matter how unlawful, and suffer absolutely no consequences, that's so counter to what we all grew up understanding our values to be. I think I'm as cynical as the next person about the Supreme Court. I just don't think there's any way five justices are going to say that. I don't think it's out of the question that Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas might say it, but I just don't think you're going to get five justices to say there is an absolute immunity.
That's one of the implications of all of these things swirling around Trump right now that bother me the most, because it would be a gift to him politically in a way, if he does win a second term, that will leave him completely unmoored to any kind of sanction or caution. I think the people around him, the Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon types of the world would absolutely love that as a broad way for Trump to exercise the kind of executive power he wants. And in the way he wants, you know, which we're seeing this weekend, talking about the bloodbaths and talking about, you know, he wants people to behave like the citizens of North Korea toward him, and all these things that autocratic expansion of power, you know, he would love to get it no matter how it comes.
Well, and also I think, we are looking at the prospect of a very different second Trump term to first term Trump. You know, when Trump was first elected in 2016, there was a lot of sense that, sure, he says silly things and intemperate things, but he was basically a businessman and a fairly standard pro-business Republican. And you had a lot of Republicans, the Rex Tillersons of the world, who was his first Secretary of State, his various chiefs of staff, who wanted to participate and say, look, this is just going to be another Republican administration. Well, Trump has very clearly said that this is going to be a very different second term, that it will be all true believers, and the authoritarian streak has come out even more. And the belief and the tolerance and the embrace of violence as a tool. Trump is this weird character, and you know better than I do, since you've spent so much time talking about him. You know, at one level, he lies all the time. But at another level, he tells the truth more than most politicians. You know, when he's talking about bloodbaths, he means a bloodbath. When he says that in immigrants and unlawful immigrants are not human, are subhuman, as he did this weekend, you know, that's a message that their lives are of less value than others, and that's what he thinks, and that's what a lot of his supporters think, and. You know, people need to understand that and take it seriously.
I think you touched on something really interesting there. Is that, you know, Trump, they used to make the joke and take Trump seriously, but not literally. I don't think we can afford that anymore. I don't think as a country, we've got an ability to glaze over that. He's not lying when he says he wants these powers. He's not lying when he says he wants to govern a certain way that would seem anathema to most Americans when they consider it.
And, you know, I have a very particular perspective on this. You know, I wrote a book last year called Homegrown.
It was terrific. We talked about it previously. Yep.
We did. Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing. We have a new podcast, if I may plug that. Homegrown. It's essentially a podcast version of the book. It's called Homegrown OKC. And you know, the thesis of the book and the thesis is that if you look at McVeigh's radicalization, and if you look at how he listened to Rush Limbaugh talking about American revolutions, if you listen to Newt Gingrich, and we're talking about the mid-90s, the Oklahoma City bombing was 1995, you know, Newt Gingrich saying that, you know, he was protecting the country from Auschwitz, this violent language has an effect, and it had an effect on McVeigh. And the same kind of obsessive interest, particularly in guns, and the idea that I am the only thing protecting your guns from seizure by the federal government, protecting you from the scourge of immigrants from Mexico. Now, those are the things that motivated McVeigh to bomb the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City. And the violence, the talk of violence Trump is engaging in is certainly going to lead to the same kind of violence sooner rather than later, as it did when he was president. You know, one of the things that I was surprised by in my research for the book and for the podcast is just how much right-wing extremist violence there's been in this country.
It's undercounted almost every time.
Yeah, you know, whether it's shooting up the Walmart in El Paso, the grocery store in Buffalo, the synagogue in Pittsburgh, earlier, the church in Charleston, South Carolina. I mean, right-wing extremist violence is something that obviously took place in the mid-90s, but going forward, especially now with the implicit endorsement of Trump, is something that continues to go on, and Trump continues to stoke it. And you know, the parsing of his words of, oh, he didn't really mean a bloodbath in the country, he meant a bloodbath in the auto industry. I mean, please don't insult our intelligence. He knew what he was saying, and we know what he was saying.
Yeah, and I think that's something that over the weekend, you know, there was a massive pushback from the right saying, oh, you know, you're taking it completely out of context. You're saying but the problem with that argument is, if Donald Trump had said this sort of thing, and it was the very first time, he would have some grace. There'd be a moment where you go, okay, you know, maybe he just got a little ahead of himself in this speech. Maybe he got a little hyped up. But over and over again, we've seen in the rallies, knock the hell out of him. Beat that guy up. If you do, I'll pay your legal fees. He wants to, you know, execute General Milley on and on. You know, everything from Charlottesville to January 6th, this ratchet. And if he hadn't started that rally by singing this alternate national anthem about the quote unquote January 6th hostages, you might interpret it differently. But I think you're exactly right. You can't give him any grace on this. You can't let it. We can't pretend as a country or as citizens that it's not that he's not serious about these things and literal about these things.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned the business about the January 6th hostages. I mean, that to me, you know, one of the great questions of the Trump era, and one in which I have been persistently wrong about, is, you know, what is the bridge too far? What is the thing he says that turns some supporters against him? And I think at this point, the answer is probably nothing. But I mean, here you have hundreds of people, the majority of whom are convicted or still imprisoned for assaulting police officers on January 6th. I mean, if there is something that the conservative movement in this country stands for, you know, respect for law enforcement, respect for people, you know, police officers in uniform, the idea that he is calling the people who assaulted the police hostages, I mean, does that not offend anyone? I don't know. I mean, you know, Rick, you and the Lincoln Project have been, you know, investigating this and calling attention to it for years now, and so you should know. But boy, it's incredible to me
that double standard of the same people who believe that Joe Biden has viciously seized their guns, which he has not. Look, has he tried to do some regulatory things? He has. The same people that believe that the ATF is going to kick down the doors of 100 million American gun owners tomorrow, you know, see how that works. It's just not scalable. Also say that they're the ones who absolutely back the police, back the blue, all that stuff. And yet simultaneously think that the January 6th folks who attacked police officers with bear spray, clubs, stun guns, everything else under the sun are innocent political martyrs. It is a really weird space in our history where you have a movement that's that wrapped up with a bunch of internal contradictions and cognitive dissonance.
It is. And Brother Rick, you have to explain it to me because I don't get it.
That explanation is something that I have struggled with a long time. And I think it comes down to the fact that there are hermetically sealed media ecosystems now where people can go and live in a media ecosystem where they only hear things that feed or sustain those contradictions. You know, the guy that's getting all of his news from YouTube channels, you know, about the coming civil war, he does not have to believe everything to be logically consistent to believe that he feels those things.
You know, if I could just go back to McVeigh and why I think the problem is broader now, is that, you know, when McVeigh was radicalized, yes, he listened to Rush Limbaugh, but beyond Limbaugh, he had to reach out for the right-wing indoctrination that he was seeking. The biggest influence on him was a novel called The Turner Diaries, which, he sold at gun shows and he found through ads in the back of NRA, National Rifle Association publications. He read a publication that was put out by the Liberty Lobby, but he had to mail away for it. You know, the key thing that McVeigh didn't have was the internet. There was no commercial internet in the mid-90s. So it really took a lot of effort to get anything beyond Rush Limbaugh. Now, Limbaugh was a significant influence, but the real intense doctrination, 24 hours a day, social media, TikTok, YouTubes, and of course, Breitbart and it's like all of that is now so easily accessible. And as you point out, the exclusive source of information for so many people, that's different. You know, the age of, you know, the three evening newscasts, you know, Walter Cronkite, and later Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings, who were such national figures, you know, reading a local newspaper. You know, local newspapers used to be, you know, relatively down the middle sources of information. Local newspapers are dying out. No one under 40 reads them. I mean, so it's, you know, the intensity of media attention that we're, for people who go only get it from one source is a huge difference.
That normative awareness that where we had a sort of shared consensus of reality is in the rearview mirror. But, well, Jeffrey Toobin, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Enemies List today. A great conversation as always, and thank you so much for your insights on where we stand in the legal mess and the political moment that we're in. And I look forward to having you back on the show again soon, and best of luck. Tell people again where they can find you on social media and the podcast.
Well, you can find me on Twitter for the time being. I don't know how long I'll be there on X at Jeffrey Toobin. But I really hope people will take a look at either my book, Homegrown, or the new podcast, which is, as they say, wherever you get your podcasts. It's called Homegrown:OKC.
Great, great, great. And folks, it is a tremendous book. It is incredibly chilling. And when you read it, you will see the outlines of the time we're in right now. You will see the precursors to a lot of the stuff that we're dealing with right now on the right. So once again, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you so much for coming on, and we will talk to you again soon, my friend.
Thanks, pal.
Over the weekend of the 16th, Donald Trump at a rally started out with the national anthem to the January 6th hostages. They're not hostages, first off. They're terrorists. They deserve to be in jail for a long time. They try to make these people into martyrs. They try to make Ashley Babbitt into a martyr. None of them are martyrs. They bought the ticket. Now they're taking the ride. Now, the big question this weekend was Trump's use of the word bloodbath, a term of art that he whipped out and said, oh, if I'm not reelected, it'll be a bloodbath. Now, he was talking about the auto industry at first, but then he said, and in many other ways. So let's be very clear about this. And I said this in the interview with Jeffrey Toobin a minute ago. If Donald Trump had never said something like that before, you could say, yeah, okay, maybe he got a little juiced up. Maybe he got a little revved up. Maybe he got a little too crazy in the speech and got over his skis. But you can't say that. This is a guy since 2015 who is engaged in an increasing ratchet of rhetoric about violence and hatred in this country that has its antecedents and parallels, as you are all well aware, in the works of other authoritarian and dictatorial menaces in our history and in the globe's history. The fact that he's there saying, oh, these immigrants, I don't think of them as people. The fact that he is talking about poisoning the blood. The fact that he's mentioning a bloodbath and many other ways, okay? That should tell you what you need to know. The pushback and the spin back on this is intense right now. The right is losing their minds over anyone who mentions it. That means you're over the target. Donald Trump is a guy who has submerged the Republican Party in a sea of violent rhetoric. From January 6th onward, there should never be a doubt about what his intention is. There should never be a question. And all the people trying to spin it, all the people trying to excuse it, all the people saying, I didn't see that speech. I was busy with something else. All the Republicans bullshitting on the Sunday shows, pretending it didn't happen. You're all on the enemies list. Thanks again for listening to the Enemies List. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.